Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Recorded in 1987, identical twin brothers Ed and Fred Ferran discuss twin feelings and how to make a career in music. They share degrees from the University of Michigan, membership in the university's Glee Club, and the Arbors, a professional voice quartet. Ed Ferran is also a composer of some of the McDonaldland jingles. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
My name is Fred Ferran, and over the past many years, you've probably turned me off many times. Now, this is my identical twin brother, Ed. Perhaps you want to tell him why.
Well, you've turned both of us off many times, most likely. My brother and I are professional singers, and here in the fall of 1987, this is our 25th year that we've been celebrating our professional singing status. We've had hit records, we've done concerts and nightclubs, and what we're referring to as far as turning us off is we have sung commercials for many years. That's the key. After you, Fred.
We don't want you to turn us off, of course. Don't run and get that beer or sandwich in the refrigerator, but we know the realities of things.
So we're here to talk with you tonight, I guess, about our singing field and whatever other questions are going to come from this voice that's out there.
So call in right now.
Ferran, that's the first point.
Ferran, mm-hmm. Right. That's right. Our last name.
What nationality is that?
That's Lebanese. It's a Lebanese name. It's spelled F-A-R-R-A-N. I tell people that if you take the last three letters and put it in front, it's Ranfar, so that's an easy way to remember the thing.
Father came from Beirut, Lebanon.
Yeah, father was born in Beirut, Lebanon, and it actually means the baker, son of the baker. Our grandfather was a famous poet at a young age, and when he was up on the stage, they'd have extemporaneous poetry battles. Someone would say a line of poetry, and another one would say another line of poetry. Well, my grandfather, as a little child, was very popular at that. So the people would say, "Who's that little kid up there?" They'd say, "That's the baker's son, Ferran." So that's what it is. We have other direct line relatives whose last name is Nasrallah. And that's what the family name was before my grandfather became a famous poet in Lebanon.
But your father came to the United States.
Right. How old is he?
I think he was 13 when he came over. Yeah, maybe 1911 or something like that. Mm. Yeah.
What did he do for a living?
Dad was, we knew him as a tailor and a furrier.
Dry cleaner.
He did work for Hudson Motor Cars, doing designing and drafting. Those are the two main things that we know him for.
We were also told that he had worked in a carnival for a while, but he died when we were 14. We never got to know him as an adult, so we never were able to interact with him as an adult human being. I have longed many times for wondering, what did he do in a carnival? How did he get a carnival job? How did he get a drafting job? When he came over here, did he have any fears or anything like that? We were told he sold papers, too, and used to buy ribbons for his sisters with a few pennies that he had. Now, he'd take that and buy little ribbons to decorate their hair.
And from the musical standpoint, I remember Dad singing his Arabic songs, or he'd do some slight Arabic dance or something like that. And so we had some of that input from him. The heavy musicianship most likely came from my mother, though.
Any recordings at all?
Of what?
Of his singing, or?
No, all we have is one recording when he went to New York to see a bunch of relation that came through in 1948 or something like that, where he spoke with no accent, no trace of accent. He had a very good ear about that. When he spent a week with his relatives, he had the thickest Arabic accent you could imagine. That's the only tape we have of him.
Well, it wasn't a tape. It was at that time. It was a little record disc. You sop into a booth, and you record a little message to send home to the folks. Yeah. And that was before the time, I think, of very popular.
Before tapes. Yeah,
before BT. That's it.
BT, before tapes.
Where did you spend your childhood?
We spent that in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That's our hometown. And a town that presumably has a high quota of lovely-looking ladies. There's a heavy Dutch population there, Polish. And it's a wonderful town to just grow up in, sort of a small-town, big-town type atmosphere.
Why did your father decide to settle in Michigan? Do you have any idea of that?
Not Michigan. I don't know Michigan. I think he had a lot of relatives in Toledo, and finally found a way to Toledo. And then I think there were some relatives. I think there was a strong contingent of Lebanese in Grand Rapids. And somewhere along the way, someone said, John, his name was John. That's why they said that. Why don't you come to Grand Rapids? There's a place for a tailor there. And I think some of the other brothers had been involved in that. And so he found himself working for a major store there, and later on went to form his own business, Superior Tailors. And most of our life then, we knew him, most until he died, as having been with Superior Tailors. He was a good tailor. It's said that he was so good that people who had physical deformities would come to him because he would minimize the appearance of the physical deformities by his tailoring ability.
My mother really can be credited with informing us on that. You know, she said that he was just wonderful at it. Matter of fact, we never had, either of us, had a pair of jeans until we were about 11 years old. All the clothes that we wore for fun were older tailor-made pants. And we longed for blue jeans because we wanted to be in with the kids. And I remember the first day I had jeans and went to school, I thought, boy, I'm liberated now.
It was like pulling teeth to buy blue jeans. Incredible.
You mentioned mother relative to the music. What was her background?
Well, my mom had her own radio show when she was a teenager. Very musical. She had what you call a perfect ear. She could hear a tune and play it in any key you wanted on the piano. Embellish it with whatever you wanted. Matter of fact, she took piano for a number of years from a teacher, and finally, after several years, the teacher discovered that my mother had a little trick. The teacher would give my mother a song to do for the next week. My mom would say, would you play that? And so the teacher would. My mom wouldn't practice all week, and she'd come back and play the song.
So she never learned to read music.
She never learned really well to read. As we knew here growing up, however, I still remember her playing the piano, heavy rhythm type things. My brother and I would be marching in circles one way, then we'd be marching in circles another. We'd fall down each time laughing and all that stuff. And so there's a very strong musical component coming from her. She also played four manual organ in our Methodist church, a congregational church before that. And Chopin's Polonaise, things like this, and just really powerful, wonderful organ things. She had a very strong sense of musicianship, and that followed through an awful lot. She never tried to make us become musicians or anything like this. Both folks offered the opportunity to go into music and piano and dancing lessons and stuff like that.
Yeah. When did you first sing in public?
We were, I think, seventh or eighth grade. There was a young gal just out of college who had been a music teacher, and she was somehow assigned to our Aberdeen grade school. And we were all in chorus there, along with all the rest of the kids. And somehow she sensed or found out that we had some kind of musical ability. And so she had a brother who was a musician. And she put the two of us together with two other young fellas. And we had our very first quartet. We were called the Lost Chords. Her brother arranged the music. And it was typically barbershop music, all a cappella work. And so we must have been maybe 13. When we actually appeared first, and it was for something like a PTA thing at school. My dad was in the audience, my mom was in the audience, and my little sister. My little sister still recalls it. I don't know how she can remember back that young. But she says she came away from the whole presentation with her face hurting because she smiled all the way through it.
It's really sweet. She says she was so proud of that type of thing. And I remember, too, we were singing on the floor level of this whole auditorium, and someone yelled from the back, "Get up on stage. We can't see you." It was my father. And that was one of the first times I know of getting a nudge to accommodate the audience, take care of the audience.
Yeah, good awareness.
And that was key.
Were you both interested in singing, or did one of you take the lead?
We were both interested in it, but not as a driving force.
It's something
it was there in our life. It was there to be a member of the chorus when we were in grade school. And when we went on to high school, it was a very natural thing to want to have some involvement with the music structure there. Of course, we had to structure our high school schedules as to what we wanted to be. Were we going to go to have a college preparation course or not? And in and amongst that, we both wanted to have singing too, but singing was not a priority by any means. It was viewed as a real fun extracurricular activity with a lot of terrific camaraderie. We liked it a lot.
What other things were you interested in high school?
Oh, boy.
Well, you know, music took up an awful lot of it. My brother and I were pretty well known in the high school. 10th grade, he was the president, and 11th grade, I was the treasurer of the class, and senior class, my brother was vice president, and I was president. Science club, who knows what else, student council, those kinds of things. What was the question? I just lost it.
Well, I was going to ask you a new question.
Okay, go ahead.
Who inherited the Ferran political machine when you left high school?
Political machine? What do you mean by that, Bob?
Well, that's when everything started to go downhill after we left, you see. That's the problems we have nowadays in this world.
Oh, I see. Okay.
No.
Ed, I
wanted to comment. I don't think you answered that quite as sufficiently as you could have, because...
our first fight.
I was very interested in science in high school, and I had determined as early as seventh grade that I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer. And how I came to that was that we used to mess around with my father's shotgun shells. We'd cut the shotgun shell apart and take the powder out and light the powder. Well, one time I made a little tiny rocket. It must have been an inch long, about a quarter inch balsa wood, and I drilled a little tiny hole and put some gunpowder in the thing. And I put on a little ramp that I'd made and ignited it with a red hot needle. And it didn't take off, but it vibrated on the launching ramp. And I had never been so excited over any event in my life. I actually felt a kind of thrill. And I concluded then, whatever I do when I grow up, I want to be somehow involved with this. So one of my cousins was an engineer at that time as a student at University of Michigan. So I concluded I had to take a schedule in high school that would lead me into engineering. And the closest thing was aeronautical engineering at University of Michigan. This is before they had aerospace engineering. So I'm an aeronautical engineer, and I also have another degree in engineering mathematics.
Sounds formidable to me.
Yeah, it's impressive.
Ed, in your case, what did you follow a similar path?
For a while, Bob. I didn't know really what I wanted to do. They ask you in eighth grade, what are you going to be? And they have you make decisions. Well, you don't have any worldly knowledge, first of all, so you might be a Boy Scout or something like this. I sort of followed my brother's path in taking mathematics. It was a pre-college thing, so there wasn't any strong determinant except for college. I figured, well, I might as well go for engineering. But as soon as I got to junior college, I just, it's just not the way I think. And so I opted, instead of what the tests showed, they came out real high in musicianship. I didn't dare think of that because my image was, if I'm in music, that means I'll be a teacher in high school. That means I'll have tattered clothes and I'll have to contend with a new crop of people each year coming up. And
it's come true, Bob. It's true.
But I decided, yeah, I didn't want that. So I opted for something else that my brother and I both grew up with through our family, and that was our cottage that we've had since we were 9 years old. We were both very interested in wild things at the cottage, rattlesnakes and bears and bloodsuckers and swimming and all this stuff and birds and snakes. And so I opted for the biological field. So I majored in biology, zoology actually, with a minor in music, of all things, in junior college as well as at the University of Michigan. And so my degree winds up being a BS in zoology, a secondary teaching certificate in biology, and then I went on with that. Because I had a real good rapport with my students, 9th through 12th grades, when I was practice teaching, I thought I need to be able to be more for them. And so I took master's work in guidance and counseling. Got halfway through that before the Army got me. Now I'm a trained killer, so watch it.
I.E.
Yes. Fred, did you study music in college?
I never took any formal music in college. I was in the Glee Club, and I was in the choruses and choirs in junior college. I never had any formal study. My brother went on in the college and took, jazz theory and a couple things like that. Yeah. I never had any formal stuff. The only formal stuff I've had in music is while I was growing up, I took piano lessons, and whatever I gained from that is my background in formal education. 6 years of piano. My practicing was terrible. I practiced about 1 year's worth of lessons.
That's maybe informative for you. We both took, six and a half years of classical piano. And we have come to realize the tremendous value in being in the choirs and choruses that we were in during high school and colleges, because some of those directors were really rigorous. And one of them in high school, if you were chewing gum in rehearsal, man, out the door you go. If you had three of those, you were out of the chorus for good. If you were chewing gum or not looking where that man was supposed to be on stage while you're up there performing, he'd just point at you, give you the thumb, and you're off.
And you walk off stage during performance, and that was it.
That really prepared us for the professionalism that's required in this business, for paying attention to business while you're there. Now, my brother and I quip a lot in the studios. We never once forget what we're there for. You know, there's clients there, you're talking about hundreds of dollars an hour that they're spending, and the humor is one way to just get through it all and lighten the load sometimes. But you have to be efficient.
Right. And our teachers, our musical teachers, were rigorous. They exposed us to a professionalism and a pride in the choruses and the choirs. Our high school choir was one of the best in the state, and it was a real honor to be in that in high school. It was especially so at that time because singing was kind of like a weeny thing for high school people, you know. And it was only because we had several football players and well-known athletes that were also in our chorus and choir that legitimized the thing to an extent that said, hey, this is okay. I think I'm accurate in that. That coupled along with the pride and the rigor that we had, we knew we were good. And when we walked out on the stage in high school, we knew that choir said a lot, and we were darn proud of the thing. I want to make a comment, too, about the accolades that come to people after a performance. During our upbringing, our first quartet was formed like in grade school. We maintained various quartets through high school and college, too. All during that time, there was nothing like constructive criticism, you know, well, that's wrong, so do it this way. What it was acceptance. It was telling us...
Unequivocal.
Unequivocal acceptance of how wonderful it was and how wonderful the audience was. I realized only in retrospect, some years ago, after I had become professional already in the music field, that this is really critical. Kids don't need constructive criticism.
They don't at the early stages of the game.
Not at the early stages of the game. When you got a rigorous instructor up there saying, here's how I want it, and has the rules as the parameters for gaining that requirement, they're going to learn merely by what that instructor requires. If they go on to choose to become professional, then they've got to contend with the public. The public will quickly tell them how they need to be. That was rapidly destroyed. The professionalism was rapidly destroyed in the 60s when people would come in, especially the rock groups, and rip the studios apart. Our own manager, who was the head of one of the major recording studios in New York, had several of his studios ripped apart by these people who had an irresponsibility. They were further indulged by the record companies who underwrote the whole thing. The record companies would pay for all this damage, and they'd have creative sessions in the studio that would last sometimes months, and it costs hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. So there was an indulgence there that was not, I don't think, wonderful.
Let's go back to that point that you're making, though. The important thing about encouraging young people, our group, the Arbors, and this is our 25th year, a number of years ago developed a series of clinics for high schools and colleges where we'd work with the students in the afternoon, give a concert in the evening. And I think one of the things that I came up with in my mind is that I wish we would have had someone like us to talk with when we were doing some of this stuff in high school, to say to the young people, if you've got something in your heart, dare to follow it. It's okay. If you fall on your buns, no sweat. It's all right. The world will keep turning, guys. You know, you'll survive intact. The original point my brother brought out was about encouraging young people without trying to be helpful. That was brought painfully home. We were doing a show out in Colorado Springs a number of years ago, and this little girl came up, 14. Her father brings her back, and she was just beaming, and she says, her father says, she wants to share with you a poem that she wrote, a song poem. And I was writing very strongly at that time, and she did. She read me the lyrics. I said, geez, that's really nice. And you know, you could change this around here if you did this and this. And that little girl's face just dropped. Makes me almost cry.
Yeah. Well,
she didn't need that then. Why do I want to cry?
because it was a touching moment.
Yeah.
Let me take you back to school. And in a sense, this is a loaded question.
All right.
Did you have any knowledge of the University of Michigan Glee Club's reputation when you went there? Was it purely academic why you chose Michigan over Michigan State?
We went there because my cousin went there. My cousin Richard was the engineer, the chemical engineer that went there, and he was my idol. He even gave me a little slide rule when I was going through school, and that's what I did all my problems with. But before we graduated from high school, we had some friends who had gone on to Michigan and who were members of the Glee Club there. The Glee Club was very highly regarded on the campus and still is, and has remained so for just decades. And they told us that how wonderful it was. And so I had resolved, and I think you had too, that the only extracurricular activity we were really going to aim for at University of Michigan, because the scholastic load we just didn't know. We assumed it was going to be horrendous. The only thing we wanted to aim for extracurricularly was the Glee Club. And so that's what we did. And when we auditioned, it was at a time there were 30 slots open for the Glee Club. 30 people had graduated the year before. There were over 300 fellas auditioning for the spots, and it was frightening. It's frightening because you know what the reputation is of that organization, and you want very badly to participate in the thing. So to answer your question more succinctly, first because of the engineering reputation, and our favorite cousins were students there, and as we got on through high school, then the music thing was a fun thing to consider and contemplate, too. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, too, Bob, because we were twins, even at that stage of the game, I recognized I didn't want to follow just because I was following my brother's career, because I still hadn't decided what I wanted for my academic work. So I chose Michigan State, interestingly enough.
I don't remember that.
I chose it, but never followed through on the thing. I followed you into Michigan by default. And
don't you ever forget?
Glad I did. It's a phenomenal school. Work, sweat like crazy. There's a lot of hard work, but that's how that came about. There, you know.
Which of you is the older brother?
I am. I'm 8 minutes older.
It's Fred. He's a little bigger. You know, he's bigger. He's a little taller. I'm younger, slimmer, trimmer.
We were both born breech birth. My mother had to join a labor union. It was terrible. No. We jest.
When you have a birthday party, do you do the 8 minute difference? And
no,
it's not too evident in our lives.
When was the earliest you thought of yourselves as twins? Do you remember?
You know, I'll respond to that. I don't know about that part of the question, Bob, but I do remember in kindergarten, the teacher would ask call a roll. She'd say, Ed, raise my hand. Fred, raise my hand. And the reason is because everybody would call me Ed or Fred, and I didn't know who I was.
And a situation which has continued
still,
for some decades.
That's why I'm in music. But, you know, it pointed out to me back then, I'm confused about this thing, you know, because people didn't know. They hear the word twin, and they automatically get confused. And we, as twins, have learned to look at twins and look for key elements in their physical makeup or something in order to find out how we can differentiate. But that's the earliest thing I recollect about being a twin. The parents didn't try to dress us alike. We wound up dressing alike many times because that's how much it was cheaper to buy this one piece of fabric, maybe, and my dad or my mom would make a piece of clothing for us, you know. But they never tried to make us twins and make us alike, for which we both are very thankful.
I don't have a recollection of really twinness being special. It was something that was with me, and I don't recall making any kind of distinction that there were other single people and I was not a single people, you know.
But I'll tell you, can I expand on that a little bit, Bob? There's an occupational hazard almost built into being a twin, and what I just referred to was either being called one or the other name. The other thing is by saying we an awful lot of the time. And I discovered increasingly in my 20s that I didn't really have a good sense of I. And identical twins, if I remember the statistic correctly, is separate on the average age of 28 years of being together. And it wasn't until our early 30s that we separated. And I knew that I didn't have enough sense of what I was about. And that was difficult for me. It was difficult for me to approach my brother on it and say, I've got to do something here, and I've got to stop us living together, being together, because it's so convenient. He doesn't smoke, I don't smoke. Don't drink, don't drink. All this kind of stuff. We're very comfortable, like shadows. So close you don't even know it. I knew I had to start identifying what I was about. And I went out, because the apartments we found together. The furniture we got together. This kind of stuff. And so the first apartment I found, I secured it. I remember the first day there, I got up in the apartment all alone. I stood in the corner. I thought, geez, now what? I don't know where the hell to start, you know, how to start putting stuff together, what will other people think with my decorations and all this kind of stuff. But that started me in doing something that would have been healthier probably, that I started doing it maybe 10 or 12 years earlier. And so it's something that I've continued to, it seems to have impacted me more than my brother. I've struggled more just assuming my sense of autonomy, and I've worked hard at it. Just to identify it, separate from this twinship. It's nothing that I'm putting down, understand that. You know, we are loyal supporters of each other. What someone does to him, they do to me, this type of thing. And yet to find the sense of autonomy has been very important to me during my life, and music has allowed me the freedom to really pursue a lot of that autonomy. That's real important to me.
You don't... obviously appear as twins.
Yeah, pardon me? We look like twins?
No, you don't.
Oh, yeah,
no,
right.
You don't.
Right.
Is there any conscious effort on your part to avoid looking like twins?
Not to avoid it. we have individual characteristics. Twins are very much the same external appearances. I think there's a lot of times internal dynamics that aren't evident to people until they really get to know twins better. And that certainly is true of us, although we have a lot of parallel interests and relate to each other's interests very well. We can explain one interest to another. I can relate engineering terms and things like that to him, and he can do natural science to me. We have our own, they're not quirks, they're characteristics of people. My brother's much more, I'll say clothes conscious, for instance. He's much more concerned with how he appears. His wardrobe, has got a very nice wardrobe. He's spent time, he's got good taste. And
keep talking, I like this.
Yes, right. Well, you can pay me afterwards. Maybe engineers in school have bad reputations.
Let me talk about engineers. You know, my brother in engineering school didn't have any girls to speak of in his classes. We would trade classes so he could go to the liberal arts school so he could at least be amongst females. All the engineers would wear their dumb slide rules hanging on their sides. You remember that. And he would go to class in his slippers, you know, this kind of thing. So he doesn't care as much about clothing. That's cool.
I have a disregard for clothing. I really don't. My wardrobe, in engineering terms, has a negative pressure coefficient.
In other words, it sucks.
That's right. Yeah. So, and strangely enough, I do like good clothes on me. I just don't seek them out. I don't like to shop. If I come across something by accident, fine. That'd be nice to get the thing, then I'll make an effort. I remember living in one of my apartments. There were three stewardesses down at the end of the hall, and our group, the Arbors, was going to go to some kind of convention, a music convention thing, and so it was a formal event, tuxedos. So I put the tuxedo on, and I went knocking at the end of the corridor at these girls' doors so they could see me dressed up. They'd never seen me dressed up. I was wearing shorts and T-shirts. And they opened the door, and one of them's mouth literally dropped. I'd never seen that before. I'd heard that being done. I really didn't give much credence.
People's mouths dropping?
Yeah. Her mouth dropped, and she just looked at me. And then she went running out to buy film so she could take a picture of me dressed up. I must say, I looked pretty good, you know. I wore my makeup that night.
Hasten to add that, you know, in our business now, when you're up on stage, You cannot look like you bought something off the rack. You have to look beyond it. You can't wear a standard tux that maybe the waiters are wearing. You have to go beyond that. You have to fulfill a certain fantasy aspect up on stage for the level that we work with anyway. Gucci shoes, patent leather jobs, because they judge, people will judge on that if they know. On the other hand, in our everyday activity, both of us wear very comfortable clothes. A friend of mine came down with her daughter a long time ago, and the daughter says, well, Mom, what'll he be wearing? And she hadn't seen me for a couple of years. She says, well, honey, probably he'll be wearing boots and blue jeans and a t-shirt or something like that. That's exactly what I was wearing when they came in. And they laughed over the thing, because that's my mode of dress now for my teaching, all this stuff, the blue jeans. It also reflects, too, just the outdoor interest, the casualness that I like to approach life with. I'm comfortable in blue jeans. I didn't grow up wearing ties and jacket like you might find in the Ivy League, for instance.
So, which of you is the most independent?
I'd say my brother is. Yeah, Ed is. He's independent. He's quested after that independence. Any independence, I say that a good share of the independence that I've had almost by default. I found it curious that my brothers reacted to various things in life with the emotionalism and the content and the evaluation that he's given it. He's quested after a certain thing, has reacted to certain things, and I find myself, isn't that strange that he's reacted like that? Because I know I wouldn't have reacted in that situation the same way. And I can't even get, one example. When we were little kids in school, some little girl called my brother a name, you dirty Lebanese or you dirty Arab or something like that. My brother came running home crying, and my mother was consoling him and telling him it doesn't make any difference. You know, that was a prejudice that we had not been exposed to. And I remember thinking, why is he reacting like that? I wouldn't have been bothered by that. I didn't give vent to it. We didn't talk about the thing. All I know is he was hurting at the time, and I was kind of surprised. That has happened throughout analysis. You've had many years of analysis with different analysts. Revelations have come about, and you've reacted different ways to things like that. And I find myself sometimes pretty darn surprised at how you've reacted to things. I don't denigrate that at all, but you've got sensitivities that apparently either I don't have or
I just treat it differently.
Yeah.
I think to pick up off your question still, Bob, is that I think I've tried analyzing myself a lot in life. My graduate work in guidance and counseling makes me, first of all, believe in the process as one of many modes of growth. And I've also discovered that I tend to reach out for things that make me uncomfortable, knowing that that's how I'll conquer it or at least be able to work with it. So when we first got to Chicago, all four of us are in the car. We get down in the loop. One of the other guys is driving. He had to hop out for something. He says, "Who'll take the wheel?" And with the split second of thinking, I thought, there's jerks driving here in Chicago. There's no reason why I can't. And I've got to overcome this reticence of this big city with all these cars all over the place. So I took the wheel. I jumped right behind it. And that sort of has represented how I tend to approach things of discomfort.
And mine is a little different. I find that I evolve into the acceptance of the thing. Rather than attack the situation, I'm going to conquer this type of thing, I will live with the discomfort of it for a while, and gradually I'll find that it'll iron itself out. And I remember that's particularly so with driving. I was uncomfortable in driving in Chicago when we first moved here, and it wasn't until I had to do some driving in Los Angeles. Well, gee, they were tailgating at 70 miles an hour on the expressway, so by the time I got back to Chicago, it was like driving on a country road here. And it had worked itself out by that time. And there's been several other times in my life and various events where I didn't really have to confront the situation. I acknowledged my apprehensions and fears, but I don't see any great need to go out and challenge them and overcome them and, by golly, be a conqueror.
Let me give another perspective to this. It's one of testing. That's how I sort of approach my life. I'm sort of testing myself. I tested myself going out to Jackson Hole, Wyoming with a backpack a week before we were to give a show there. I went out with $3 in my pocket to see if I could do it. And I had no previous places to stay or anything like this. It's illegal to sleep on the side of the road. And I thought, I'm going to see what I do in a situation like that. And
I have to commend you on that, because you can really find that you can survive, that the world is not a horrendous place that is going to create difficulties. And I think with that kind of outlook, I think that's a boon for you. I commend you for it.
Well,
I'm chicken.
Let's come back to music.
Go ahead.
How much time do you devote a week, a day, to music?
Actually, what we do, right now the arbors devote 20 hours a week about to rehearsal.
Sometimes we schedule that.
We schedule that time to be together, sometimes not a notice sung at all. And we've acknowledged amongst ourselves that that's critical also, because we keep in tune with each other, whether we're talking about politics or whatever it is. And it keeps us close in ways that translate and transfer to the stage. It may not be necessary with other groups, but we find it very enjoyable for ourselves. We find it keeps us nicely in tune, so much so that's one of the things we're known for on stage, is our ability to read each other very critically, even if we're not hearing back too well on monitors or something like this. We're so sensitive to each other that any of us can read when the other one's got a breathing problem or can't swallow exactly right, the saliva built up or something like this. We can do this on a 50-foot stage, all spread apart with our eyes shut and our backs to each other. We have gotten so tuned, we can listen to each other, take a little breath like this. We know where that's at and when we can come in. Because of that, we're known very much for our critical, our expertise at singing a cappella very well. We pride ourselves in that. And these 20 hours of rehearsal a week, rehearsal time, are very critical. Many times when we come to practicing, we'll spend hours on just a bar of music or a couple of changes of music or something like this. It's tedious as ever. It's not, I don't enjoy it personally, okay? Some of the other guys...
You don't enjoy the rehearsal.
I don't enjoy the rehearsal.
Our times together, though, when we're rehearsing with the guys, or in our rehearsal meetings, we talk about everything under the sun. That's not a planned thing. We haven't said, okay, let's devote this meeting to just talking about things not of music. It just evolves that way. And what we found, I think the best description of it is that the other two fellows are Tom and Scott Herrick, and they're brothers. So we're two sets of brothers. And we find that we've got a marriage of four people there. And I have to liken it to a marriage, although I've never been married, nor has my... We're both single, everyone. Please call in. that we have to confront the things that are bothering us. And that's all the stuff that I've read and studied about, is how people should relate to each other, for instance, in marriages. Discuss the things that are uncomfortable situations. And so we've discussed them. Sometimes we have marvelous arguments. We're sitting there screaming and yelling at each other and really taking offense with each other. But we've also agreed that we will destroy ourselves if we let that go out of the room. And so every time we leave, and this is kind of fun, I take great pride, and I think all of us do in the group. When we leave after a horrendous argument, our question will often be, what are you guys doing tonight? We will drop it at the time we leave. It's marvelous. We take pride in that.
If they would only realize, Bob, that I'm right, we wouldn't have all this stuff.
That's true. And so am I. Teachers and students, you're both.
Yes. Well... Are you questioning about the teachers we've had or the fact that we are teaching now?
Both.
Okay.
As I understand it, you're both teachers and you're also both students.
Yes, that's true. I've been teaching voice for 10 years now. My brother's been teaching a little over two. Let me say this about teachers and students. This is a wonderful thing for a teacher to remember, in my estimation. A teacher is always a student. And that's something really wonderful about that mentality, because I'm learning all the time and I'm becoming better and better all the time. I'm pretty good now at what I do, and I'm still keep learning. And just,
if I might interject,
please.
My brother has one of the best reputations in the city for his voice teaching. He's got a very sensitive ear, and he has the intuitive sense how to pull things out of people's voices. He's got quite a few professionals as students. When plays and shows come to town, there'll often be people seeking some vocal guidance, and his name is often suggested, and he is often gets calls from stars coming to town for vocal work.
There's we both are still students. Okay, we've been singing for 25 years. The last 15 both my brother and I have been taking voice lessons from at least one teacher. I currently study with two teachers here in town. I do seminar work with a third person out on the West Coast who studies a voice in a different way from what I do, and I admire his work very much, so I study with him too. That's all to stay on top of this whole thing about the voice. There's still, we know a lot about the voice right now, and there's a lot we don't know yet. But
and there's valid objections among various voice teachers. There's marvelous research going on now as to the physical organism that we human beings are and how it relates to the voice. So there can be teachers that are diametrically opposed in their guidance to students. We are both of the sort that say to our students, we may not be the right person for you. And there's a small contingent of us here, I think, in Chicago, that is a very giving type contingent. We say to the students, stay with us for a little while. There may be things you might not care for. We might have personality conflicts or so. If there is, and if you want to drop out and explore something else, it's your responsibility as a student to explore something else. This is what we wanted to do years ago, but we found some teachers that were, you're going to leave me? They're the god of the student. So I tell my students, and my brother does a parallel thing too, I think, I'm not going to be a god for you. You owe it to yourself to explore other areas. If you're going along and your roommate says, God, my voice teacher really is doing some great stuff, and you find something that's kind of interesting and you want to give it a try, give it a try. If you want to find that you want to leave me to explore that, go with my blessing. I'm not going to give you a guilt trip. And if you're learning something new, will you give me a call back and let me know what you're learning different? And if you can, maybe I'd like to sit in because I want to learn more. That's the only way, I think, to anticipate the real world, to anticipate what real students are, because we've been in that situation, and kind of anticipate the difficulties and the changes that are going to go on without messing yourself up. It's been very rewarding.
We both really take that same stance too, Bob. The first lesson, the first meeting has always got some kind of a setup talking to the student. And I tell my students, in addition to what my brother just said, is that you have an obligation as a student to expect results. And if you don't get them from me or anybody else, leave. It's that simple. Give it enough of a chance to give it a shot. And you should, during your lifetime, have at least a couple of teachers that you work with. Your job as that student is to take the truths, the things that you're finding, and see which are your own truths, see which relate to you. The rest, dump. And that's true when you're in grade school, when you're in junior high, if you're in high school, whatever. Understand, if you're of that bent at that time, to say, I'm learning something from this director who's a crummy director, say. I hate him. I don't want to be in this chorus. The other one says, he's real tough and all this kind of stuff. In retrospect, I look back on that and say, boy, those were some really good lessons. Now, I'd like to implant that in when I'm giving my clinics. And again, through the teaching, there are people who are sort of born teachers, or they're bred as teachers, givers. I think my brother and I both do that. Lord knows I had enough teachers in school who were not teachers. They were academicians, and they were there for research and publishing, and they couldn't teach for beans. I'm sorry to say that out of 6.5 years of college, I had 3 teachers that I really felt were excellent teachers.
I might comment, too, that when we give the clinics for high schools and colleges, and the students are there, and there are many teachers of music there at the same time, we'll tell the students that what we have to say as professionals has been our experience. These are the conclusions we've come to. They might be quite opposite and contrary to what you've been told by your instructors to do and how to be on stage. For now, ride with us. We're not telling you that we're right and your teachers are wrong. They might be exactly right for what you need at the time right here. We might think of something different here. Ride with us for the day here. We'll tell you what we're all about and what we do. And tonight you're going to see us put into action what we claim to be our truth here. So we've been wrong. We have had opposite comments to those instructors. I've had people come up to me and say, yeah, our instructor wants us to do such and such a thing. And I said, well, I'm not going to say it's wrong. My goodness, you know, might turn out to be right.
Well, the neat thing is that we actually go to the instructors and we talk with them beforehand. We say, we may say things that are contradictory to what you're telling the students. What we want you to know is that we're here to support what you're doing, even if we disagree.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Very nicely
that's
said.
That's the point.
What aspect of your, if I could
go ahead.
Take us in a different direction.
Go ahead, interrupt.
What
it's
aspect
all right.
of your, what aspect of your careers in entertainment do you most dislike? I think that's something an aspiring entertainer would like to know.
I'll tell you right away.
Okay.
I sure do. The level of our entertaining has been very, very high. We've performed for a lot of major organizations and heads of state around the world for many years. We have never gotten to the point where we have our own self-contained support mechanism of carrying sound systems and equipment and lighting systems and all that. So,
Is our group alone.
This is our group alone. Now, what we do is we carry our own sound system with us. There's a guarantee that we know what we're going to have sound system-wise, because we could be the best group in the world, and if you got a lousy sound system, the audience is not going to know it, and they shouldn't know it. They're not supposed to know that stuff. So we carry our own system along with us, and we carry our own musicians with us. And when we decided to take on our own musicians, that was a godsend, too, because we could now rehearse long before the show. But carrying the equipment with us, going into sound setup, physically manhandling that equipment, going through sound tests and balances to make sure the acoustics are what we want them to be by the time of the show is a real chore. I really hate it. I would like to have that responsibility on someone else. And if that someone else is like a company that we hire in another city to come in and do the stuff, then that'd be their responsibility. All I want to do is go out and sing and have a good time. I'll evaluate the system and come to change the qualities if I can do that, but I don't want to lug it around.
Let me point out something here that I think we're probably among a few groups who do all of our own luggage and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Most everybody now has roadies to carry their own equipment, things like this, or at least someone to do that work.
We're cheap.
We've opted to do that all ourselves. We ship 800 pounds of sound equipment on the airlines as personal baggage, stuff like this. So we are literally our own roadies, we're our own sound crew, this kind of thing. This is what he's talking about. I think most groups now have the people to do that for them. We've just never done that. Yes, we could hire it done. It's not real cost effective for the level of price structure that we have for the organizations that we've been doing for the number of years. So he's sort of moaning about that right now.
I am moaning, yes.
Obviously, the audience is the final focus of all this. But do you like to meet fans?
Oh, I love it.
Oh,
I love it, yeah. It's a real lovely experience to be accepted on stage. And it's even a greater experience to come off the stage and have closer personal contact with them. I like very much to interact with the people in the audience.
In fact, this is one of the things that the agents really like about us. If you're doing a play in high school and you come out in your garb, you know, your gowns and all this kind of stuff, there's a little bit of show-offiness about that. What we're talking about is a little different level. People like to rub elbows with the people who've been on stage. And that's one of the bonuses that we get here. I personally just don't appreciate too much the stars who hide themselves, seclude themselves after they've had a performance or will not see anybody. We like to make ourselves available. Now, yeah, if you're overrun by people and you can't get away, that's another story. You have to pay attention to some of that stuff.
Well, we've never been that well known to have that kind of activity take place.
We like it very much. The people talk with us, and there's another opportunity. Sometimes we get mothers coming back with their kids and say, try to convince Johnny not to be in show business or something like this. And now you're between a rock and a hard place. How do you encourage the kid, and how do you keep the parent happy too? Those kinds of things are wonderful challenges. In every respect, I think all of us just enjoy very much talking to the people, relating to them. You know, the songs that I write and sing in the show, people come back, ask for the lyrics of them, things like this. That's all
very
fine. That's part of the business. One of the reasons I'm here. I'm not just here to make money. If I were here just to make money and run off stage, that'd be another story. It revolves around an awful lot more than the money.
I was delighted some years ago, after I'd become a professional entertainer, to realize in evaluating my life that the value in my life was the people that I met. And once I really verbalized that, I came to accept and allow things that might be considered just time-wasting things. I have a new appreciation for the suburban housewife who comes to town with her girlfriends to shop and have lunch. I'll do the same thing, and I'll enjoy it. The people in the life are the things that are really, they're the things that make life worthwhile for me.
He loves to go shopping with a suburban housewife. Dangerous, but it's fun.
Have lunch, yes. I always have lunch. I have a philosophy of life, Bob. Would you like to hear it?
Certainly.
All right. The only reason for doing anything is to eat afterwards. You see?
And if you'll pull the camera down a little lower, you'll see why.
Don't do that because this vertical pattern will split around the buttons, you see. I defend myself.
Well, both of you have done, as you started out this discussion telling us, you've done many, many commercials.
Yeah.
Performed in them, been the voices in them. I assume they pay well.
Good assumption, Bob. Real good.
Are they equally satisfying professionally?
Ooh. Yes. As a matter of fact, here's the interesting thing. Doing a commercial is a very different challenge from singing and performing and entertaining on stage. And it's very different, say, from doing a record session where you're doing your own project, say. Each one of those have different elements in them that are challenging and lightening and refreshing and all this kind of thing. The challenge in commercial singing, number one, it's assumed that you're going to have good pitch, and it's assumed that you will read really well. Not so much now with more of the rock singers, with more of a street sound, this kind of a thing.
That is read music.
Okay, good, thank you. So there's a real challenge there in getting the job done quickly, efficiently, and the challenge of blending with other singers that you maybe have not sung with before, and yet in maybe 5 minutes being able to sing a finished product.
Because what you've come into the studio with is no idea, usually, what the music is. So you're given the music, you have to read this stuff, and come to a conclusion pretty fast on how the whole treatment's going to be with everyone singing there. And in 5 or 10 minutes, you're doing final takes on the thing.
Now, for that kind of expertise, and there are people who read a lot better than we do and all this kind of stuff, for that kind of expertise, there's a lot of money exchanging hands. And what I call A singers, the ones who are called much of the time for their particular voices, tenor, soprano,
first
whatever.
First call singers.
The first call singers, they earn it because they're that skilled, very much so. Commercials have kept the arbors as a foundation of its income, anyway, for 20 of our 25 years, doing commercials at the Jolly Green Giant and Schlitz and Texaco and McDonald's and United Airlines and Cessna Aircraft and stuff like this, you know, all kinds of stuff. It's had its ups and downs. Right now, at this time of the year, the commercial business in the country is undergoing some strange turnaround. None of us know what it is, but
well, part of it seems to be the electronics. The contemporary sound for hit records nowadays focuses and deals with a great deal of the electronic instruments. Those instruments can be taken and put into a small room, so any producer can go in without a great outlay of money and do a complete piece of commercial work without hiring 87 musicians and 14 singers, and get a finished product out without a terrific amount of overhead. So we have here in Chicago at this time, more and more singers coming on board wanting and chasing fewer and fewer jobs.
Ed, I understand you've written commercials also, is that?
Yeah. I have kept a real low profile. I really haven't pursued it much in these last several years. But at one point, I was approached by one of the production houses. McDonald's was their account, by the way. And they said, Ed, I had asked these people to make demonstration tapes of some of my tunes and play the piano and all this kind of stuff. So, Ed, all kinds of houses have tried this particular thing for McDonald's and everybody's failed. You might as well give it a shot. And it turned out to be McDonald's land that they had this huge football field-sized thing with all these hamburgers and French fries and all this kind of stuff, characters, and they couldn't find a slant for it. And so they said, yeah, just give it a shot. And so I did. I came up with a 2.5-minute record version of all these characters and stuff, and they bought it. And
it won an award, didn't it?
Yeah, it won an award.
Was that the first
That was the first introduction to McDonald Land.
Well, was it your first effort at trying to compose a commercial?
Yes, for a commercial it was. Not really. There was a very marginal one, I won't mention the product, years earlier, that was a very local type thing in one of the way into one of the suburbs, another state. But this was a worthy shot. I did a good job on it. I like it. It's a compelling little ditty, and
it was used.
It was used. My brother and I sang the we sang the commercial for it. So not only did I make money for creative fees for the music and lyrics, but then we proceeded to make income off it for singing it. And it became network and regional plays, local plays, this kind of thing.
Well, we haven't paid for entertainment today in a pure sense, but could you share with us a little bit of that ditty?
No, but thanks for asking, yeah. Bob.
We can do the beginning of it. I don't know that people will remember it right now, but it had to do with McDonald Land and introducing the characters. And so the slant that I chose was to have Ronald McDonald taking a little boy and a girl throughout McDonald Land, or whoever they decided they wanted to. So I designed the lyrics to keep it open enough so he could take whoever was there. And it went like this. The beginning part of it went like this. That's a little too high.
Get yourself ready for a trip through McDonald Land. Take along a friend and grab a hold of Ronald's hand.
Now, this is just the beginning of it, but look what all the capacity is there. By the way, I've taught lyric writing for commercials
in college,
as one of the colleges here in town. And one of the designs I talk about is that you want to sometimes, if you're not doing a hard sell with specific things, 7-Up has bubbles in it, it tastes like blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff, then you have to find a slant that allows people to fit themselves into the scenario. And in this case, go along with Ronald McDonald, let him take you by the hand and all this kind of stuff. That could have been anybody. And going on this adventure through McDonald Land. So it left it wide open. So, yeah, I'm proud of that one.
Well, you really have, both of you, been involved in a wide variety of things.
Yeah, it's a great life, Bob. Yeah, it really is.
Do your future plans coincide?
Gosh, I really don't know.
You know, I'll tell you this. We are beating the odds by being a group of four guys, the same four guys for 25 years. I believe the statistic is if you see anybody on the top 100 of the charts, they will exist for 2 years and that's it. We've beat the odds very, very much, and we've made a terrific income through the whole thing. But even more, it's allowed us, one, to express ourselves in something that we find very meaningful. It's allowed us also the freedom then to explore other doors that open up. We didn't just have to pound the pavement. We didn't just have to punch a time clock for somebody else. It's riskier. We don't have a pay plan to watch out for us if we get sick and all that stuff. You do get pension and welfare and things like this through the unions. But you pretty much take responsibility for your own existence. Bob, I know that's been a big, strong thing on your part. Yeah, anybody who's in this business is not looking for a paternalistic or a maternalistic company to watch out for them. They're biting the bullet and going out on their own, and they could fail miserably, and there's no one to pick up the slack.
What we've agreed to, though, is if the business ever is such that we have so little work that we're actually doing an act of performing, and we've gone on to other arenas of activity, we still want to sing. We'll still keep the quartet together. Now, it might be singing once or twice a year or at parties or something like that. It just might not be in the full professional sense. We all have our outside interests that we focus on, too.
So that's... Yeah, what's down the road? We're going to keep singing as long as we love it and as long as we're valid and credible and able to achieve entertainment value, as long as we're excellent in our music. We aim for excellence. We wondered at the beginning of our career, what should we aim for? These were first discussions. What should we aim for? Fame, blah, 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 blah.
What are the criteria of success?
The only thing we decided that was worthy of pursuit was excellence. If we are getting better, then money should follow. And luckily, it's been that way. And who knows how much longer it'll last. We've been exploring these side doors. I could make a total income now on teaching alone if I wanted to. So could my brother. The other guys are involved in other things as well. But the thing is, for any of you sitting out there and want to be a singer, people say, I want to be a singer. To which we say, don't say you want to be a singer. Sing. That's the thing. Do it. Be it. Bite the bullet, and that's where you need to go on it. We'll keep going as long as we can.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.